2 or something. I'm sure he doesn't remember. I was just another face in the crowd when he was introducing something called outlining to the world. This is the outlining you now find in PowerPoint and that you now find in Word, not nearly as well executed as Dave did it with Think Tank, which was his original product there. His fingerprints are on all kinds of things that we do today, and he hasn't asserted any intellectual property rights over them, which I think is just a heroic thing to do, and that's one reason it's spread as well as it has. Dave is not just a technologist, but a publisher, and comes from the publishing world. That's one reason why outlining and his approach to the publishing that we do on the web as a read-write thing, as Tim Berners-Lee described it in the first place, has gone as far as it has. He was instrumental in getting the New York Times to do RSS and getting other major publishers to do RSS and help start the fire that became. He was a fellow for, I think, 2 years with the Berkman Center at Harvard University at the law school there, where I'm also a fellow now. And it was there that held the first BloggerCon, which I think may have been the first unconference, which we'd like to make this if we possibly can. So Dave's fingerprints are on unconferences as well. And I'd like to start out by talking about, or having Dave talk about, subjects that matter. There's a, and maybe you just take it from here. There are two big ones that I'd, just in the outline sense, want to put up front: war and the elections.
Right. Well, thanks, Doc. We discussed how he would introduce me before, and I suggested that he put a paper bag over my head, and that as he's doing it, there's a secret thing over here, and then here's Dave, take the bag off. So this would be that moment. I really asked to come speak to this conference, and because when I found out that, I think of this as the NPR conference. The guy in this morning said it was the PBS, but I think of NPR as being over-encompassing. And I'm a total NPR fan, have been for virtually my entire life. I wanted to come first to thank you all for the support of podcasting. And I'm not sure that anybody has actually done that, and so I figured somebody ought to do that, because, and Tony Khan here, Tony, you want to raise your hand, was one of the early pioneers of podcasting. Right. And I worked with Tony when he was at, he still is at WGBH. And I got through Tony a sense of what the political environment is at, in public broadcasting. Not that Harvard University, which is where I was, didn't have its own political environment. Big organizations always do. And so, to me, it's a miracle that podcasting has taken root so thoroughly inside of NPR. Like I wrote on my blog a few days ago, I said, geez, we'll know it's really over the top when Fresh Air has a podcast. And within 5 minutes, I had an email saying, get with it, Fresh Air does have a podcast. So, and that created a problem for me, because I only have so many hours in the day to listen to NPR podcasts, and now I had to make room for Fresh Air. But honestly, I don't think podcasting would be, well, let me just put it this way. I don't have any numbers to back this up, but I can say for me personally, podcasting would be nowhere near as valuable to me if it weren't for the support that we got from the public broadcasting, from NPR. So that was my first thing. I wanted to say, job well done. Thank you very much. And also to the thing that the guy was saying this morning, I was at the keynote this morning, and he was giving you a hard time about how do you get onto the internet. Well, I wanted to raise my hand and say, wait a minute, they are on the internet, and they're doing it in the way that makes sense for them. And podcasting is very much where you ought to be. So I'm very happy you're there. Now, I'm also coming from I like to think of myself as coming from the publishing industry, but I also have one foot very deeply planted in the tech industry. And it's kind of really where I come from, although I'm not happy with the tech industry and haven't been for quite some time. And I think that we have to do a lot better in the tech industry at producing a device that plays podcasts in order to get podcasting to really deliver on the promise that that justifies the investment that NPR has made in it. I outlined on my blog a few days ago what I felt was missing there. The device that we play this stuff on, mostly, I guess, iPods and similar devices, were not designed to play the content that comes from NPR. It was designed to play albums of music. And while that's very valuable, and you know, I wouldn't ever diminish the value of being able to listen to music on a portable device, it's very, very, very different activity. A piece of music is something that you buy, right? And it's something that you cherish, you hold on to. You buy a song, you might listen to it 10, 100, 1,000 times. A podcast, you listen to once, and it's gone. You might, if there was something special about it, like if your child was in the podcast, you might keep it, right? If it had some personal value to you, but it's not designed to be kept around. So the device that plays it would seem to be very different. Also, I think a podcast player should be a two-way thing. I should be able to record a podcast on my player. And that goes to a sort of background discussion that's been going on in the hallways here. I hear it loud and clear that the future of public media is going to embrace more the contribution of the individual. The idea of an audience is kind of an obsolete concept today. It's not about audience now. It's about community. It's about Doc mentioned unconferences, and the concept of an unconference, we observe that the people we used to call the audience have a lot of intelligence, have a lot of information, have a lot of experience, and that if we can find a way to tap into that, we can have a much more informed and much wiser and valuable flow of information. So it's got to be two-way. And the pod player, the things we use to play podcasts today are not two-way. They're very, very much one-way. And the third, it's not to say that there aren't small features that we need too, but there's the third really big thing that we need from a podcast player is that it be possible to add software to it once you've purchased it. So today, when you buy an iPod, basically you're stuck with the software Apple gave you. If you couldn't have a software development community develop around an iPod because there's only one vendor that has the right to actually put software onto this machine. And that's fine, but you can see that all successful platforms that have ever come along out of the tech industry don't have that property. They all have the property that, and the more successful they are, the more open to other software they've been. The Apple II was open, CPM open. The MS-DOS, wide open, Windows, the internet is the most open thing we've ever produced. These were all raging successes. I think the iPod has been successful because it's had no open competition. It's had nobody coming at it with the sort of wild and crazy world that comes about when you have an open platform. They have some idea. The issue came up with the iPhone, and Jobs says, well, you wouldn't want your phone to be open, would you? I'm paraphrasing. And the answer is, yeah, I would like it to be open. Not only that, I'd like the iPod to be open as well. So those are ways I think we get to, once we have all that. Oh, there was one other thing. It has to also be able to receive new programming without tethering to a computer. Too many levels of synchronization. It's too complicated. In other words, I want Wi-Fi on the podcast player itself. When I come within range of a Wi-Fi signal, a light would go on, I press a button, it automatically syncs up, and that's it. It should be more like radio, I guess is the point, right? I mean, it's kind of what we're doing, right? You know? And now it's more like playing music, right? Well, that's wonderful, but that's not really what we're doing, okay? So I think that once we get there, and I'm giving this talk in a lot of different places about the technology of it. I'm writing it. I have a few articles in the loop. I'm going to be pushing this now with every ounce of my ability to promote this idea that we have not yet reached the point where we can sort of sit back and rest on our laurels. The tech industry has not reached that point. This is not a to-do list item for you guys. Now, I do have one for you, all right? Which I think is very much in sync. And Doc mentioned the war. And the war, and so we're going to flip all the way out. Okay, that's technology, and it's wonderful to talk about technology in a vacuum of, well, if we were living in a time of peace, which we are not living in a time of peace. And it looks like it might get worse. And if we look at how we got here the first time around when we were contemplating going to war in Iraq, what kind of a discussion did we have in the United States? And I would volunteer that we didn't have a discussion. We didn't have a democracy at that moment either. We may have had it in a legal sense, but we didn't exercise that democracy. And had we done it, I think we would have found that a lot of people had a lot of reservations about going into this war, and that maybe we really didn't want to do it. And I see that as a failing of, well, let's say that it's a systematic failing. It's the whole system failing. But I think, and we had to go through a lot of steps, I think, to get to the point where, I mean, what's the problem? I'm going to try to put my finger on what is, if there is a failing, where is that failing? And I think it's that we didn't want to listen to each other. There was no mechanism for it. If we spoke up, we didn't feel people would listen to what we had to say. Now, the blogging world actually did discuss this as we ramped up to war with some trepidation, because there's a lot of brutality in the blogging world. It's not a very friendly place to express a contrary opinion, but yet there was discussion. If you go back and read the archive of Doc's blog, you'll see that he raised a lot of questions about the war. The New York Times, not exclusively the blogosphere, the New York Times ran an editorial, I think it was the day before the war started. They said, maybe we ought to take a look at why we're actually going to war. But did we learn the lessons? And you look at the front page of the New York Times last week, they had that article about the Iran weapons and Iran importing weapons into Iraq. And they didn't put the caveat in there that I feel they should have had in 2003, which is this may be government propaganda. Okay, well, after what happened in 2003, here we are in 2007, the article, again, didn't question, even in the slightest, whether or not we're being fed propaganda. Now, everybody, whether you live in a blue state or a red state, has that intuition now that maybe we are being lied to. Okay, it's not a hard thing to sell in the United States, or in Great Britain, for that matter. People are suspicious of the government and how they get us ramped up to go into war. And there was a wonderful segment in On the Media, I think it's the current, it's last Friday's On the Media, with the author of that New York Times article. And Brooke Gladstone was pressing him on that exact issue, what's going on here. And I was astonished. Growing up with NPR, I grew up with the New York Times. I'm from New York originally. And we always had the New York Times in the house, read it at the kitchen table, discussed it over dinner. It was a part of our life. I look up to the New York Times. This guy didn't understand the question that he was being asked. He said, well, why should I raise it? It doesn't seem germane to the subject. Well, you should raise it because you're talking to intelligent people who deserve to know that you're not owned by the government. Because in the past, it really looked to us like you were owned by the government. So, and I understand in saying this that there are probably people in the room that disagree with a lot of what I've said, because I'm expressing a political idea, right? But probably not so much here as would if I were giving this talk in, say, Nashville, Tennessee, right? There's going to be a different kind of discourse in each place. But where I would like us to get is to a place where we can have discourse and listen to each other respectfully and hear ideas we disagree with and actually consider whether or not they're making a valid point. And where if a journalist like this guy in the New York Times makes that kind of an error, which I consider an absolute error, and not just the reporter's error, by the way, one of the selling points of the mainstream media to us in the blogosphere is that there is this process that the editorial stuff goes through. There are a lot of eyes that look at this stuff and a lot of brains and well-educated and honest, high-integrity people. I think this is a systematic failure there in that. I don't think the Times has done anything to correct the errors that came up around the whole Judith Miller situation. I don't think they've fixed it, right? And while there's no equivalent statement to make about NPR, the discussion didn't really happen on NPR either. and it isn't really happening on NPR now. So the challenge, and the challenge isn't how to revitalize NPR or make it more relevant in the age of the internet. That's not the challenge. I think the opportunity is to become highly relevant in political discourse in the United States. So you're looking at a vacuum here. You're finding that the commercial media is simply not doing it. Now, they have their reasons for not wanting to do it, but I don't think those reasons apply to public media. They have to try to go for a least common denominator. Each one of them is competing for this theoretic. They want to get back to the place where the three major networks were before the explosion of different, you know, choices in media. Well, that's their problem, but that's not our problem, right? I see our joint problem as being how to inform people who are intellectually able and how to have that discussion that we're not having. I don't know that this specifically is going to solve all of our problems, but I strongly believe in an intuitive way that this is on the path to solving those problems. That we have no excuse. There's no apology that we can make that's sufficient if we don't do that this time. Because it looks to me like we're going to war in Iran now. And I think it looks to a lot of us like that's what's going on. That by this summer, we will be in a war in Iran. I was talking with Rob about this earlier. And a former colleague of mine, John Robb, was telling him that it's not in our interest as a country, and it's not in Iran's interest as a country, but it is in the interest of our president, and it is in the interest of their president. So guess what? Seems pretty likely we're going to have it. The question is, do we have the force of will? And I think that we do. Do the red state people have to listen to the blue state people? I've lived in red states. I'm a blue... Did I get that right? Yeah,
no, you got it. All right. You're on it.
Sorry.
You're on it.
I'm so confused by this. Yes, I am very much a blue guy, but I've lived in red states, and I've met intelligent, educated people I have very high regard for, who just have a different political opinion on certain things. I don't think this is one of those things that we differ on. And I think that we can broaden the reach of public media, and in doing so, revitalize the national discourse. And I think that if NPR had a mission like that, that the existential problems that NPR has would fade into the distance. That there would be a purpose, and when people have a purpose, the problems don't get in your way anymore. But when you lack the purpose, when you're stuck doing something that's just that you don't believe in, or that we all know, I think in our heart, that we have to do better at this thing. We have to discuss these things. We have to expose facts. We have to say when we think they're lying. You have to say that. I read a wonderful Krugman editorial in the run-up to the war. You know, he said that the typical way a reporter works is that they look for two sides and say the truth lies somewhere in between. Well, if somebody says the earth is flat and somebody says the earth is round, this is what Krugman said, it isn't true that there are two sides and the truth lies somewhere in between. The reporter has to take a stand. When you know something for a fact, you can't present it as a difference of opinion. When somebody says the earth is flat, the story is, this dude is lying. You know?
Or wrong.
Well, or he could be wrong, but in case of, everybody says Bush is really stupid. He's not stupid. He's not wrong. He's lying. My opinion. Now, put me on NPR, or somebody was willing to say that, and put somebody else on NPR that's willing to say Bush is not lying. But not somebody who says it through ad hominem attacks, through talking stupid to the audience. In other words, there are eloquent, educated, interested, accurate voices on two sides of everything, and that's what you guys ought to be doing. Act as curators for people who have passion for their ideas and embrace discourse would be my... I guess it's more than a request. It's a plea. I flew cross country to ask you to do that. So that's what I wanted to say.
As a
I'm done.
Yeah, well, yeah. No, you're not.
Wait.
Could you actually go
Can we get you a microphone?
Yeah, there's a mic
because
right back.
I should say
Rob,
we're streaming.
A mic standing back there.
Can you repeat my question? What about 2008?
Right. What about 2008? Rob says, "What about? Do you mind?"
Before we jump into it, I just wanted to say about in looking for those people, John Robb that Dave mentioned earlier is a blogger, but he's a retired Air Force colonel who flew Black Ops helicopters on 70-some missions. He's probably the leading authority on the subject of his blog, which is Global Guerrillas. He's got a book coming out, and he's saying, and I believe John more than I believe anybody else I read, that we are going to war. This is not the feeling he has now, the knowledge he has now is the same as we had before. We knew we were going to go to war in Iraq. We didn't even need the weapons of mass destruction excuse. It was going to happen, and we knew it was going to happen, and it's going to happen with Iran, according to John. So this isn't he said, she said. So this is a guy who knows his stuff saying this. So on to the elections. I just wanted to get
right.
That
well, 2008, and that was good. I knew I'd forget something. That something is important. I think that we have a huge opportunity with the election, with 2008 approaching. I was around peripherally. I was not a supporter of Howard Dean, but I made it my business to be inside that campaign enough, and I was lobbying them much like I'm lobbying you guys right now. My request for them, and this was 2003, was that they should take some of the money that they raised, and they were had raised $40 million, and had a machine that was generating huge amounts of money, and that they should put some of that money into blogging infrastructure. Because this was a problem we had at the time, is that if an ordinary person wanted to start a weblog, there really wasn't a way for them to do that. And it's hard to imagine that world ever existed today, because now you've got a plethora of choices, any number of different places. So the opportunity that existed in 2003 just simply doesn't exist in 2007 and for the 2008 election. But this is the opportunity for the 2008 election, which is how can we, let me back up for a second. I think the process is that instead of presenting us with an array of choices of people to vote for, that's putting the cart before the horse. I think before we make the choice about who we want to vote for, because if we do it that way, we're going to do it the same superficial way we always do it, which is going to be on how, does he part his hair on the left or the right? How does he look? You know, what is Chris Lydon, a friend of mine who was at Harvard, obviously also an NPR guy, used to say when you put somebody on TV, the only thing anybody ever looks at is their hair, right? And that's what we tend to look at in our candidates is, well, what kind of hair does the guy have, you know? Or in the case of Hillary Clinton, the woman have. We don't know anything about these people. We end up electing a guy who says no nation building, who then proceeds to go and build nations, right? So flip it around. Let's say, okay, electorate, what do we want? What do we want from a president in 2008? And then let them reconfigure themselves to try to appeal to us. Well, that is the opportunity. I mean, you see the candidates, you know, the only one I've met with so far is Edwards. And Edwards really does want to get into the blogosphere. And so he's, you know, spent the years leading up to the election building his roots there. I'm not a supporter of Edwards. But he really tried. You see them all, Barack Obama. Oh, by the way, I would put the video from PBS on YouTube, and I would forget about trying to create a website that does what YouTube does. It's silly. YouTube is wonderful. That's where everybody's going to be looking for the damn video. Save yourself some money. Focus on what you do really well and put it up on YouTube. I mean, it's a no-brainer. I think I just saved you $20, $30 million, too. And you give me some of that, too. You know. Or use that for another project, which is, you know, use YouTube, use Flickr, use the tools that are sitting out there. Oh, Doc had a wonderful idea. Let's come back to that. We won't forget.
We'll come back to this. We'll come back. Bookmark on that and stay on the election.
Right, the election. Right. So you don't try to do what was done in 2003 and 2004 and 2007 and 2008, because those are no longer the opportunities. There are already needs that have been fulfilled. Edwards fell flat on his face with all the stuff he did. As earnest as Edwards is, and he's very, very earnest, that's not what the world demands of you today. If you want to do what Dean did in 2003, well, first of all, why would you want to do what Dean did? Okay, let's look at exactly what Dean did. He raised $40 million from the public and then turned it over to Turner and NBC. He bought ads with it. I mean, for Christ's sake, is that really what we thought we were giving him the money for? To go spend the money on putting ads in mainstream media? And look at how corrupt the whole system is, okay? It is unbelievably corrupt. The mainstream media decides who's going to get the money. How do they decide? Well, come on. They present a candidate in a positive light. They make them look good on TV, right? So the people who give money to the campaign say, oh, this person's electable. Electability means the TV likes him, right? And so they give him money, and then that guy turns around and gives the money back to the TV networks, right? So basically, they're sales reps for the TV networks. That's the job of a political candidate, and that's got to change. That's sort of core, right to the core of the problem. Now, that's the bad news. The good news is you guys don't have that conflict of interest. Here you are, mainstream media, okay, and you are mainstream media, but you're not participating in that system. You're not. If you're getting the money, you're getting a tiny little piece of that money. You get so little of that money that you can afford to zig to that zag, where the mainstream guys can't afford to do it. They have to stay in this loop. They can't. The commercial guys, I mean commercial mainstream, they have to stay in this loop or else they're out of business. These guys are raising $1 billion each in their campaigns. If they don't have that $1 billion in revenue, their stock price goes down and they get fired, right? So the challenge is to bring the constituency in and give them what they want. So the question is, what did the people who gave the money to Dean, what were they asking for? What did they want? I mean, that's kind of where I stop. You know, I think that each of us, why did I give $100 to WNYC? Because I love the On the Media podcast. I gave it because I want them to keep doing it. I don't want them to stop. And they asked for me to give them some money, so I gave them the money. It's a no-brainer to me. So if NPR is helping reform the political process so that it is more intelligent and makes more sense, I think it goes without saying that if we like what you're doing, we're not going to let you go away. Right? And I think that's ultimately where you have to, that's where you have to appeal. And I think it's a delicate little thing, but to get people to believe in you and what you're doing on the 2008 election, you have to get reality into what you do. It can't be playing that Washington game anymore. I want to hear what the pundits say over dinner. I don't want to hear what they say when they're on the air. I want to hear what they say to each other when the microphone isn't on. I want your interviewers to cut to the chase and say, hold on a minute, what you're saying is bullshit. Tell me what you really think, okay? Because how many times do you listen to the radio and you think to yourself, like every time, I'm just getting a bunch of BS here, right? I think you have to bring that into your product and do it with class because you guys have class. You don't want to throw that out. So you don't want to use the word I just used, okay? But you kind of, can Terry Gross put that into her voice? Yeah, I think so, you know? Brooke Gladstone, go listen to that segment with Brooke Gladstone. She was on fire. She was wonderful. That was absolutely the kind of radio I want. I want a lot more of that. I want people saying to people who are coming on and either being dumb or lying, I want you to communicate to the listener that I know that you're being dumb or lying. And then bring the people in. Let's find out what they want. And it can't be done in man-on-the-street interviews. You need to bring them in with their own voice. I guess one more thing is, this, I believe, is the prototype show. That's the one. That's the idea. That's the one that I feel is the furthest out along this curve in the entire repertoire that I'm aware of. It could be that there are other shows that are like that. So... yeah. Okay, that's great. A good idea.
Yeah.
Well, we won't forget the...
No, that's
the,
right. Yeah. I won't forget it. We got time.
I really appreciate your patience, by the way. I'm getting the ideas across that I wanted to. So.
Good. First of all, I'm a giant fan of blogs and podcasts, and I recognize that they are really important to future discourse. But I want to play devil's advocate for a second and have us discuss kind of a conundrum that's built into the concept of blogs, which is the great thing about most blogs that are particularly that are politically oriented is that the blogger makes their bias explicit by way of developing some integrity with the audience. This is my viewpoint. I'm saying this as my viewpoint. It's personal. But it's not journalism necessarily. Some blogs are, but the blogs that are about political opinion and about discourse tend to be sort of more column. This is my explicit viewpoint. But the bad thing about blogs or about expressing an explicit viewpoint is that it tempts the reader to seek out the blogs that reflect the reader's viewpoint, to the exclusion of blogs that don't reflect the reader's viewpoint. Meaning, I suspect it is happening already where most readers are kind of creating, blog readers are kind of creating a hall of mirrors with their series of blogs that they read on a daily basis. So they don't seek out and on a regular basis spend time reading the blogs of viewpoints that are on the opposite end of the spectrum. I imagine the hardcore blog readers, such as yourselves, probably do read a wider spectrum. But the average blog reader may just stick to kind of the hall of mirrors. These are and believe in a sense that that's actually the viewpoint of the entire country, even though it's really just their subset of particular viewpoints sort of collected together. I think that kind of goes against the idea of the blogosphere increasing the discussion, increasing the discourse. In a way, I think it makes a case for the ongoing need for broadcast programming, at least from the NPR perspective, that is trying concertedly to create a balanced viewpoint at some level.
I agree. I think there is a role for public radio. I wouldn't be here if I didn't. Yeah. I didn't come here to tell you. You know, there's been a big misunderstanding in the conversation we're having, that not between you and me, but overall between mainstream and bloggers, okay? I, for one, am not against mainstream media. I want mainstream media to be great. So I'm not saying replace you with me. I'm saying, but you got to do your job better, okay? You got to stimulate us with, find a way to stimulate. I want to hear an eloquent representative of the other point of view, but I do watch Keith Olbermann, okay, because I do find it relaxing to hear my point of view expressed in a humorous way, and because I'm so fed up with, there are some nights when you want to get the news and you go through the cable TV network and all the flip the channels over there. And there's nothing, it's happening right now, there's nothing but Adam Nicole Smith on there. And this is an abrogation of their duty, you know. A guy like Keith Olbermann makes jokes about it while he's doing it. Like, I can't believe they insist that I have to do this all the time. So there's your opportunity. Okay, I'll flip it back to you. Can you take me out of the hall of mirrors but without me losing my self-respect? In other words, what I want to hear is intelligent points of view from the other side. There are some issues like, what's the classic one is abortion, right? I mean, nobody is pro-abortion that I know, okay? I mean, yet the rhetoric comes out. So if somebody comes on the radio and says, I'm pro-life and he's pro-abortion, somebody ought to stop him and say, well, show me somebody who's pro-abortion. Well, first of all, do you agree? You're being characterized as pro-abortion. Let's stop right now. Do you agree with that characterization? Probably wouldn't agree with it. So, there's a respectful way to do this. But if you do it respectfully, how the hell can you question somebody's belief? You know, I can see that maybe some people think abortion is bad and should be illegal. That makes some sense to me because I don't see it as a black and white issue, right? We have black and white. We have these issues that are not black and white. So start there. Give us discourse on things where reasonable people can disagree and present them as being reasonable. And let them make the reasonable arguments. But when it starts becoming, in other words, you shouldn't become a hall of mirrors, right? NPR, I'm not advocating in any way that NPR become a hall of mirrors. I want dissonance to become an art that's practiced in our country. And I want it to be an art. I want us to appreciate each other, even especially when we disagree on things. You know, let's go back to the founding fathers and what were they thinking about this country would be? Can we be more like that and less? So yeah, when I see a blogger doing that, you know, it bothers me. I don't see there's this huge line between what we do and what you guys do. I just don't see it. And I think that line is getting more and more. I think as understanding increases, you know, as you find more mainstream people who are blogging, I think that they understand. It's like, you know, I'm a blogger means, like, I have a cell phone in my pocket, you know? I mean, so what? I have a blog. Okay. You know, that doesn't mean I'm any different from anybody else because given in a few more years, yeah, everybody's going to have one, right? I mean, I think so. I don't know. But thank you. I mean, you know.
Let me add a few things. I'll try to keep
it. It does say Doc Searles and Dave Weiner out there.
Yeah.
I know. But this was our deal.
We have an echo chamber.
This is our deal. Doc and I can finish each other's sentences.
You're not
I often try to. You know?
Yeah. very well. Blogs are journals, okay? This thing about what's journalism and what isn't is very often an excuse for not talking to the people who do not have the orthodox credentials. There has been for a long time, and we talked about it in NPR last week, a tendency to do the safe thing, right? And the safe thing is often who you talk to as sources, right? There are. I gave a speech like 5 years ago, maybe more than that, like seven. It's not long after Clue Train came out, which is a book I co-wrote. And the speaker right after me was Robert Siegel of NPR. And he was lamenting that we were getting to the point where where Reuters and AP were contracting, and the number of sources, the number of first sources in so much of the world was contracting, and what on earth are we going to do? Well, the answer has come. There are just a zillion sources out there. And Dave's point, basically, is there are lots of sources. And a lot of them, we mentioned John Robb before, are highly credentialed. But they may not be, you know, like Jeff Jarvis, who's a friend of ours, who's a great blogger, is on CNN and places like that all the time. Why? He looks good on TV. He talks well. He speaks in Final Draft. You can write down immediately what he says.
He looks good?
Yeah, I think he knows he looks good, so why not? He's tall. He looks like Lincoln, sort of.
Yeah.
And he speaks emphatically. You know, there's no doubt in what he says. And so he's telegenic and he's audiogenic, and it's great. But there are a lot of people like John. So maybe I've never seen John quoted anywhere that often. I think he's a good-looking guy, but he may not be comfortable in front of a microphone. He may not be. He may end up being the most obvious choice in the usual way, but he has the goods. And there are an awful lot of people out there who have the goods. There are a lot of people another friend of ours, Phil Windley, is the former CIO of Utah, and he's he runs IT Conversations now, took over from Doug Kay, who's a few doors away, calls one-person NGOs. There are a lot of obsessives out there that are one-man NGOs on some subject, and they know more about water quality, they know more about roads, they know more about some religion, some other subject. And the wonderful thing about Google and about Technorati and about some of these other search engines is you can find these people pretty easily. Even Technorati, though I don't like the way they do this all the time, you can sort by authority, meaning number of inbound links. You can look at them one time and tell whether or not they're proselytizers for a point of view or if they really do have the goods. The point is the sources are out there. They're speaking. And they're not all loops. I mean, Andrew Sullivan is struggling publicly as a conservative, as a Catholic, as a gay guy, as a journalist, a whole lot of other, as a supporter of the war, you know, with how screwed up this thing is and how we're going to go to war and what.
There you go. That's a good example of somebody whose politics I don't agree with, but I can respect the hell out of, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a good example, right.
So there's a rich, there's an enormous... There's an embarrassment of riches.
I'm not sure
there.
That Doc's point is actually the point is that the blogosphere is the unbundling of all the sources. Anybody that hasn't been able to get their ideas out there through mainstream media over the last whatever it's been my blog will be 10 years old in April, so it's been a long time already. So all these people that have been sort of stifled in getting their ideas out there. That's the people you hear from on blogs. They're not all gadflies, and they're not all flaky. Some of them are scientists, economists, professors, ex-captains in the Air Force. They can be knowledgeable people, but you have to separate, you have to figure out how to qualify them, but they're now making themselves known. So that's maybe another way to connect up with the blogosphere.
I just thought of a great story, okay? There's a story that you guys need to cover. There's a blogger in the state of Utah who I think he's the former Speaker of the House in Utah. Now, I think he runs the equivalent of the Utah House Ways and Means Committee. His name is Steve Urquhart. He has a blog, a site called Politicopia. He is I don't know if he's Mormon or not, but he's certainly a Republican in a pretty much a one-party state. He's collaborating with a bunch of lefties from New York City. Britt Blazer was probably the biggest and most hardcore Democratic volunteer supporter of Howard Dean. Mika Sifri, writer for The Nation. And a bunch of other people on this Politicopia project, the whole purpose of which is to connect citizens with governance. And the very first thing that got passed because of the way Politicopia worked was school vouchers. It was essentially a Republican issue. But then the next thing, I don't know what happened exactly, but the next thing kind of went a little bit on the left side. And it didn't go the way everybody expected it to. But what happened were a bunch of people who want to get out of the echo chambers, who are engaged in government, who are engaged in journalism, who are engaged in other things, on their own, using, this is a very important point, tools laying around on the ground, okay? The world is full of tools. Dave's created a bunch of them with RSS and with OPML, many other things. There are tools growing on trees that are easy. This is a slight subject change, but it's an important one. I heard somebody say earlier, we have to pick a player, like one platform for our streams. That's a really bad idea. There are so many ways to cheap out that work for everybody in tools right now. If you look at the people who are actually producing them and putting them to use, the cost of whatever Politicopia was is approximately nothing. And really interested, caring people who come from all over the political spectrum are making that thing work. That's just one project that's going on now. And they're trying to do it for really good and healthy reasons. But it doesn't sort into right versus left. It doesn't sort into stories that are who's fighting whom.
I got one. I got one. It was in today's New York Times. A neighbor of mine in Berkeley, Joan Blades, who's one of the founders of MoveOn.org, is partnering with a woman from the Christian Coalition in a mother's organization called MomsRising.org. So, I mean, and part of it is, well, they want to support the political issues of motherhood, but I thought, and they know this, obviously, the incredible part is that MoveOn.org is obviously very left-wing and Christian Coalition is very right-wing. And so putting those two people in the same organization and sending them out on a press tour together makes for a pretty interesting story. Yeah? What?
Moms Rising will be speaking tomorrow morning.
Oh, well, Moms Rising will be speaking
Moms
tomorrow.
Moms Rising, good.
Yeah. Cool. Who's next?
So other questions, so we don't...
Comments are okay, too, by the way. It's not just questions.
Over there. Yeah.
How much time do we have left?
Mark will tell us.
How much
time?
Give
us the... You've got time.
20 minutes, my goodness.
So what would you say to those that would say that time-shifted content as well as kind of the personal aggregation that comes along with podcasting and feeds and everything kind of is more divisive than mainstream media because it eliminates kind of that collective civic moment or a historic moment of gathering around the TV, or things like that. Does that make sense? I think it's kind of...
What isn't like that today? I mean, why single out podcasting and stuff? I mean, what about video games? And I mean, what about people walking down the street listening to iPods? I mean, these are the times we live in. We may not like it, or may think there are negative sides to it, but that's like fighting City Hall. I mean, I like to to say, I mean, basically, I can walk down the street with my own soundtrack now, you know. And sometimes I feel like John Travolta in, I don't know if you've seen the scene in Saturday Night Live, it's like the opening scene, Staying Alive.
He's just like da 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 da.
You know, so like, I'm in my own world.
Dave is disco.
Disco. You're too young. You don't know anything about disco. Oh, you do?
Yeah.
You do? Oh my goodness.
No frills.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, you know, there's always the good with the bad, I guess. I mean, yeah, it's lovely to sit around and hang out with your family and experience that love. It's wonderful. It's barbecues are nice too, and you know, let's have more of those.
A couple thoughts. One is, primetime radio in the 30s killed off the front porch. Primetime television killed off primetime radio.
We'll get back to it.
We'll get back to a lot of this.
You know, what's going to happen? What's going to happen is BitTorrent's going to kill off the radio industry, and then we're all going to have to make our own music, and then you're going to have to sit around, let's play Kumbaya for your family. So everybody's going to be happy. So just wait a few more cycles. And I'm only joking. Although I have been crucified by the RIAA. I gave a talk in 2000. I thought I was going to get crucified here today, to be honest with you. I gave a talk right around the turning point of the music industry when Napster was raging. And I went to explain to them how wonderful it was being a music fan in 2000, because now I can program my own music. They tolerated me for about 15 minutes before the bricks start getting hurled. You know, so I don't know. You guys are great.
Rob, yeah.
Sorry.
I wonder today, I think there is a community. It's not we're all sitting at 7 o'clock and Bonanza is on type of thing. But the community, I'm sitting next to a wonderful guy called Ben Rowe who knows more about music than I'll ever know. And you know, there are whole... I was talking to Jay Kernis the other day and we were saying, how could we leave what we do and be gazillionaires? And he's thinking, I'll start a Broadway site. You know, it'll just be Ethel Merman and stuff like that, and people will, you know, come and see that site because there's a whole community that loves Broadway shows. Or Ben and I were talking about, I was a choir boy once, there are how many million? 65 million people in America have sung in a choir.
Wow.
Now, we're not all going to necessarily meet up, but, you know, I'd like to be part of that community. And I'd like to talk online to other people who love, you know, choral music. So I don't think it's going to be 7 o'clock Bonanza, but it could be we all meet up in our own time to talk about Bird or something like that.
I'd like to go back to the first part of Dave's talk. It occurs to me I'm a longtime Apple user. I have an iPod. Apple got some traction with that because not only did they simplify the entire user experience, but they notably integrated a hardware device, a piece of software, which is the iTunes music software, and a service into one seamless, relatively, what they call seamless experience. That, if anything, accounts for the popularity of the iPod in making some sense out of a very disconnected, open, non-standardized universe. So, you know, I think if you are willing to accept reality, that's the times we live in, that's the problem they dealt with in doing that. I would love to see the iPod be a more open device, but I'm not sure that an awful lot of the people who use iPods really want that. That's one thing. The other thing is the device you call for already exists. It's a cell phone. You know, I happen to have a Trio 650, which is a Palm device. It's an open platform. You can add all the software. You can stand to it. It doesn't have Wi-Fi. Mine doesn't have Wi-Fi, but it does have a network connection that you pay for, a lot of money. And so, you know, the kind of operation you anticipate with the addition of... You have to manage it like a computer platform, and I'm just saying that for the sophisticated users, which includes you guys and a lot of us, it's not an issue, but for, you know, the general public that we deal with as broadcasters, it is more of an issue.
Is there a pod catcher for the trio? Are you aware of that?
In other
words,
not.
Is there something that will download RSS feeds that have MP3 files attached to it? Or,
I mean, if you could imagine it, it pretty much exists. Nokia does have a device exactly
right,
like you're talking about.
Yeah, and they're getting there. And it doesn't have to be Wi-Fi. I mean,
yeah.
I'm interested in the functionality. I'm interested in the ease of use. I mean,
yeah.
You were absolutely right. The design of the iPod is a selling point. I mean, I have bought probably a dozen different, MP3 players, and the one I carry with me is an iPod. So, it's the best of a first generation. I mean,
right.
The iPod is. I think there's no doubt that we'll look back 10 years from now, and look at the iPod and think that it was a good first effort. But I don't think it's what we're gonna. I think we're gonna see something much nicer. And more tuned. I hope we see something that's more tuned for podcasting out of the box.
All right, well, let me ask you a question about that. Others have argued that podcasting is itself an intermediate or transitional technology to the era of pervasive wireless networks. At the point where
of
you
wireless
have
what?
Networks.
Uh-huh.
Real cover, in other words, substantial coverage of urban and suburban America by wireless networks so that everybody who now has a broadband connection has a connection to a portable device. At that point, do we really care whether the thing is downloaded or streamed to us on demand?
Wait a second. I do think I care, absolutely.
Okay, I'm just saying why, because there your functionality is more or less identical. Then we're arguing about the amount of latency.
You asked a question. I need to pause for a moment to collect my thoughts, but
okay.
I do absolutely do care. Streaming has never been. Why do you care if it's streaming? I mean, that's why I care. In other words, the reason why broadcasters care if it's streaming is because they want to retain some measure of control over the content. I mean, that's why anybody wants streaming, and I'm sorry, I want control of it myself, because I'll tell you in the past the reason why, and the reason you say, I don't even know who you are. Who are you, by the way?
Stephen Hill with Hearts of Space.
Okay, I don't know what business you're in.
I'm a radio producer,
okay.
And I also...
Why do you care? Why do you want streaming? I assume you want streaming.
I can tell you why I want streaming is because we have a licensing regime. I'm a music producer, and we have a licensing regime that allows me to...
Well, I don't want music. This isn't about music. Podcasting, to me, isn't about music. Podcasting is about the programming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is music on NPR, right? Okay? But that's not really... I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Well, actually, of course, there are shows that are primarily music. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the news talk show type stuff.
Right, which is content that is proprietary to the producers and the networks. That
right,
produce.
And you want to retain control over it, and that's...
No, I don't.
Can I add something in here?
Of course.
Yeah. I don't want to interrupt. I don't like doing that. Part of the circumstances is, Stephen, you brought up two different cases, essentially. One is the streaming case today. The other is the ubiquitous Wi-Fi case tomorrow.
Right.
In the streaming case today, we do have a regime that has actually required that most podcasting, especially by larger organizations, cannot be done with music because of the rights issues. And it can be done with streaming because of the DMCA that came along in 1998 and the CARP decision in 2001 created a very clear regime that you, as a broadcaster of live material, operate inside of, right? And that's a comfortable one for you, and you have listeners and you have stations that play what you're doing. And that's something I would like to see happen is for everybody in this room, if they possibly can, to work with their congresspeople and so forth to get the insane copyright laws that came along in the 1990s.
I'm not really referring to that limitation, which is a restriction on music, copyrighted music only. I'm talking about a service issue only, which is once I have an on-demand stream that I can get when I want, start, stop, and navigate within, what's the difference? If I have an agile enough network connection, the only difference I can see is a half a second of latency while a server catches up with what I want. Is that
okay? I don't see why we have to get stuck on this, okay? I like podcasting. I don't know whether you do or don't.
I don't like or dislike it. I'm asking what you think the impact will be of having this level of networking when it arrives.
Okay, I don't have an opinion about that.
Okay. I do, which is I don't think we're going to have it as long as we have the carrier duopoly that we do. They have no interest in it.
No interest in what?
In a ubiquitous Wi-Fi cloud everywhere. And I also don't think
But Doc, can we move on? I don't see why this stops this particular conversation. In other words, why do we have to stop here to discuss this?
Okay.
Could you accept? He has an opinion about it. I said I don't.
Okay.
I don't know how bad everybody else feels about this.
Okay,
It's not a deal stopper.
How many minutes do we have, Mark? We have another question back here, right?
No, Doc. There could be a comment, too.
There could be a comment.
It could be a comment, and it doesn't have to be a question.
Yeah, it could be either one.
Good point.
You raised the discussion of using the community that we're creating as an open source base for journalism. And in fact, that is going on, if memory serves me right. I've seen a presentation recently from Minnesota Public Radio where they're doing something very, very similar to that. And it's really quite exciting. If somebody from Minnesota Public Radio might want to give it to you in more detail. Secondly, as I'm in another lifetime of mine, I spent 22 years in commercial television. And as a part of mainstream media, having to deal with candidates and the election scenario every 2 years at the local level. Never worked at a network, but 22 years in local commercial television. I can't say that I disagree with you that it's broken, but I think you give us credit for being a shill far and above what we are or what we were. But I do think there was a day ago, a glimmer that I hope you all saw, which was a top 50 commercial affiliate who has created an open community on his website that is fundamentally opening the doors on a commercial television station, a commercial network affiliate in the 30th ranked mark in the country.
Can you say who that is, just so we know?
Yeah, it's in Nashville.
Right, yeah. It's Terry Heaton's client. Yeah. WKRN, thank you.
Yeah, WKRN. Okay. And it's an extraordinary expression of a commercial broadcaster looking out to try to accomplish the very things you're saying that they should be doing. Now, we may be late, we may be slow, but the environment around a commercial television station at the local level, when the candidates come parading through your door, that's been created both by the law and the history and the candidates and their desire to get elected, the amount of money that becomes at play, is not a fun environment for any commercial broadcaster that I have ever had the pleasure to discuss this with. I don't think they would disagree with you that it's broken. But I do think they would have disagreed with you that they were playing some sort of role as a shill for anybody. And certainly, I think they would have wished as hard as you do that there was another way to do that stuff.
Okay. I don't think I called them exactly call. I didn't use the word shill, for sure. But I point taken. Well, the system has the net effect of being that. I mean, whether it's intentional or not, I don't know.
Tony?
How much time do we have left? I can turn this from a comment into a question, depending upon how much time we have.
Go for it.
Well, I just want to speak out for what I think may be an aspect to podcasting and its relationship to broadcasting that hasn't been touched on. Because I get the sense that we're sort of seeing them as being, in a way, forms that are trying to figure out how to mate, how to breed or interbreed. We're not quite sure they're going to have viable offspring or what the hell the process is. And I've heard podcasting referred to as a new technology or a variation of an old technology. What I'd like to suggest is that it may not be so much a new technology as it is a new medium in the making. And a new medium doesn't yet have a clear anatomy until it's created. It doesn't have a clear relationship to its audience or to the preceding medium until it's developed. And one of the things that does not seem to be happening in at least 2 years that I've been involved in podcasting, which is soon after you, Dave, you know, made it possible, is that public broadcasting has not been looking upon podcasting as a place where it can start to experience a different relationship with an audience and perhaps develop new programming. Almost, I venture to say 98% of the podcasts that are coming from public broadcasting are merely repackaged aspects of its broadcasting. And, you know, they say, or remember Marshall McLuhan, he said that the content of every new medium is the old medium. Well, that's true to with a vengeance in this case. And for those who do decide to look on podcasting as a new field where relationships are just beginning to take place, that this is really, really early days, there is so much to be learned about what your audience is, what kind of relationship it wants with you, what great ideas you may get from them, what great new production technologies they may even be working with in their own kitchens that we don't know about, but that we can find out about if we go there as good neighbors rather than as people who are trying to transport all of our content and values to this new space. We have learned an enormous amount from our audience. And the main difference, someone asked me today, say, what's the biggest thing you've learned from 2 years in podcasting? Probably it's that the relationship that you have with the audience is very, very different from the relationship that you have with a broadcast audience. Maybe because the internet that brings the programming to you is also the same tool that you can use to get back to somebody. You hear from your audience immediately. They are engaged in something that's much more like a conversation. And they are eager to participate and to partner. Now, I know, Dave, you feel that it should be as much as possible a two-way street, you know, that the podcasters, everyone should be a podcaster. Maybe that'll be...
You don't?
Okay, then I misunderstood
no,
you.
A lot of people say stuff like that, but I don't. I think it should be whatever it is. You know,
well, one of the things that it could be is it could be sort of a place where people with common interests, as one of the gentlemen before me said, can go to share a common passion about something, and it can be sort of moderated by the person who is running that popular podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm just praying that...
Well, you're on a podcast right now, by the way. So is everybody else who's spoken.
Oh, well, that's nice to know.
Oh, absolutely. You're also on a live audio stream.
Maybe I'll hear myself after I've heard the 800 other podcasts I've already got downloaded.
Absolutely wonderful.
But anyway, that's the point I'm trying to make to public broadcasters.
I heard you on some game show.
Yes, as you.
Yeah. Yeah,
right. Yeah. Which, unfortunately, isn't being podcast for reasons that totally escape me.
Well, I totally agree that... I feel it's sort of like a... Why don't you stay at the mic? It's sort of like we're at a tenuous moment. I almost don't want to... I almost thought maybe I shouldn't call attention to the fact that NPR is even doing podcasts because by doing that, maybe they'll stop doing it, you know? Mm. Because it feels like a gift to me, even just getting the existing programming out through this channel. It feels like a gift, and it feels like something that could be taken back. So I'm happy with what's been done so far. But I think that the more that you could do, Tony, and people like yourself that are skilled in this art, is you could help teach those of us who are not how you do what you do. Because, I mean, one of the things I pride myself in, and one of the reasons why it gained traction was that when I did my podcasts, they were sloppy. They were, you know, there were gaps of an... There was a gap of 10 minutes in one of the early ones I did, you know. Yet it was, and that was actually, it wasn't deliberate. I would never do it deliberately. But But it did show people that you don't have to hit the, you know, NPR level quality in order to have your ideas have value and have the expression of those ideas have value. But that said, I would like to see a podcast school. You know, I mean, Doug Kaye, who's next door, through an unfortunate, I would love to have been in his session, teaches how to do podcasting at a different level. But how does a guy like you do a radio show? That's something I'd love to know more about.
I'd like CPB, for one, to consider...
You'd like what?
I'd like the Corporation for Public Broadcasting,
yeah,
for one, to consider the fact that maybe they should put some money into encouraging people who are good and experienced producers to produce something that's original podcast material. That would mean they would have to venture out into that world and form relationships.
Or teach us how, and then we'll create 1,000 hours of... Maybe this isn't a very popular idea, but teach us how, and in 20 hours worth of training, we'll produce 1,000 hours worth of programming. You now have so many more hours. If you take 24 times the number of public radio stations, that gave you a very finite number of programming hours that you have had. I'm sure you've been through this story many, many times. Well, now you don't have any limit on the number of hours of broadcasting you can do, because podcasting doesn't have that kind of a limit. So can we broaden that? That would be a way to achieve the discourse for the 2008 election.
I'm sorry, Dave.
No, actually, you know, maybe the takeaway is we could have a special seminar about this at some point, you know, maybe a half-day brainstorming session somewhere where we get together and we talk specifically about how we might do this. You know, that doesn't require a lot of funding to do that, you know.
I've got about $1.75 in my left pocket right now. I have about $1.75 in my left pocket if you want to start collecting.
Okay.
Just one very quick point, if I could, Doc. I've heard it said that the way broadcasting, and you're suggesting the way the broadcasting should get more honest in its news, hard news coverage, is that it should get better experts, more honest people, more forthcoming about where they're really coming from.
Or just hit the larger talent pool, that's all.
I think that one very concrete model that podcasting may offer broadcasting for how to deal with controversial issues is to stay away from rhetoric completely.
Away from what?
Rhetoric completely. The model that broadcasting basically operates with are talking heads who are engaged in a fight to see who wins the argument. Mm-hmm. This polarizes, and it doesn't persuade anybody, nor does it help explain why somebody feels the way that they do about a controversial issue. Podcasting provides much more of an opportunity for people to sit down and talk about what led them to the political conclusions the way they would around a dinner table. And that means that the possibility of finding common ground for a solution is suddenly open, something that broadcasting tends not to offer. So that's one way in which podcasting might, you know, provide a model that broadcasting could adopt.
Very good.
Just to go back to a prior point about having a workshop or something, something that is requires almost zero revenue and can be extraordinarily productive are workshops, like you just brought up, like Dave began with the blogger cons. The idea isn't that you fund some big expensive thing, it's rather that you just get a room with the right people in it and tasked with moving the subject forward. It's incredible how well that works.
I just want to add what I just told Doc, which is if the people in this room want to just continue, feel free. I'll close the doors so that the sound from outside is cut, but we just don't get to hear the quality of conversation you guys are having that often.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Continue
thank
as
you,
much.
Thank you guys. Right. I wanted to bring up the point that we bookmarked earlier. This morning somebody was talking, I don't know about what, but it came up that there's a front line coming up on some subject or other. And I just had this idea because I just only discovered BitTorrent in the last couple days in a useful way, that what a PBS could do is at the same moment that they're distributing a live program through the expensive system that's out there, that they could be the alpha seed, and that's what they're called, for a torrent. That means you have the one server that is 100% uptime, but what happens is as soon as you release that piece of video, everybody who's downloading it also becomes an uploading source. That's how BitTorrent works. That, by the way, is what blows away the need for transmitters entirely. You distribute the cost, and there's zero revenue required
other than the server upkeep on the first server. So that's a great way. And it came out of something Dave said, which is he would like to see the front line before it goes on the air, right? That's
so I could review it.
So we could review
it. So I could help the same way you see the, you know, the reporters at the major newspapers who review the shows before they come on. I mean, I can read a review of today's show, tonight's show, in the paper in the morning, so I got to conclude that he's seen the show, right? And bloggers don't get that kind of advance. But to really do it right, what Doc says, why play favorites among bloggers? Let everybody on the web have the show 24 hours before it broadcasts.
What would that do for the broadcast?
It couldn't possibly hurt it because you don't have commercials on it, right? I mean, and by the way, if it's your official distribution, then you can leave the sponsorship messages in it. My guess is that they get taken out when somebody else is doing the uploading. So I think we've more or less exhausted the points.
I know,
unless
so
somebody else has anything else to say.
Anybody else have any other comments or anything? Or do we?
I'm starting.
Have we run out?
To talk. I think I made every point I wanted to make. So
I'd like to make one more, actually. And it comes up with this distinction that we're trying to make between what's live and what's stored and forwarded. An interesting irony there is that the stuff that's stored and forwarded, as Tony just pointed out, there's a much more intimate relationship that happens with podcasting, what you're doing with podcasting, than happens when you're talking through a transmitter and through radios. And an interesting thing too is you, as soon as you publish the RSS feed that your podcast is up, Technorati and Google Blog Search have found that within about a minute. And there is I've said this before in some of the in another session, there is a branching going on in the net between the static web that we build and construct and have designers for and has an address and a location, and we understand almost entirely in real estate language, and the live web that is people interacting with people, people publishing, people writing, people syndicating, people feeding, people seeding, another one of those words, with BitTorrent. Torrent is live. It may be about storing and forwarding, but there's something about the word torrent that is inherently live. And that's radio. Radio is, even if radio is stored and forwarded, radio is live. Larry Josephson, who walked in here and out earlier, who's one of my great heroes. He's one of the very few people around whom I am starstruck because I am in awe of what he did in radio that made it personal long before Howard Stern got out of high school. He once said, in the only other conversation I had with him prior to this, that radio is personal. There's something about radio that is personal. Well, now with podcasting, it really is. And it's personal for everybody. It's not just personal for the people behind the microphones in the large buildings, behind the towers with the big transmitters. What can we do with that?
Okay,
thank you.
You guys.